Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwane aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 120.
PL timestamp, day 1713, afternoon.
Scroll practice. How does that go? Anything explode?
Reading a scroll is sort of like pulling the magic on it off the page, like pulling extremely sticky tape off a roll. It is incredibly easy to get it all tangled and stuck to itself, at which point the scroll is wasted. Though with the scrolls they got him, that's not an explosion, just a waste of a scroll.
Does he succeed at any point?
Yeah. About a tenth of the time, maybe getting a little better with more practice, but still very chancy even once he's been practicing for most of the afternoon.
Perhaps he shall try this again when his brain is less tired. Or if it's just down to practice, then practice it shall be.
Pull time stamp, day 1713, late afternoon.
Keltham takes time to hang a first-level wizard spell. No point in missing any practice there either. And then announces an optional lecture on civilization's governance. The topic came to mind for some odd reason, though his brain is still too tired for chemistry or real math.
The lecture has perfect attendance despite being optional. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, he sort of figured that might be the case. If it goes on being the case, it means there's no such thing as an optional lecture, really. But, never mind. The way civilized kids get introduced to this, or at least the way Keltham's class got introduced to this, on reflection, he doesn't really know if that was universal or special to some quality that Keltham had with all the other kids. It's not particularly obvious what that could have been, but it's been a while. Anyways, the starting question is, suppose that some passing super-powerful aliens on their way through tapped civilization with a powerful mimetic field that wiped all knowledge about anything resembling a government structure or social organization. They've still got stuff like probable utility and decision and the fair division algorithm, but they can't remember anything about legislators, delegates, elections, or even that such a thing as governance is possible. They're just standing around blankly in the middle of everything that civilization has built, trying to figure out what to do now. They have to reinvent even the concept of government from scratch, and they don't particularly know that's what they're supposed to be inventing. But again, though these people are now utterly ignorant of government, they are not ignorant. They already have concepts like cooperation, defection, dilemmas. They are standing around in a total void of particular social organization, but they are allowed to be very clever and think very quickly about new orders that would be possible to create within this void, so long as they really do that from scratch. How do they reason? What would they try? What are their goals? What would they invent, and from which first principles?
Well, says Gregoria, the first thing you need is law enforcement. Otherwise, society will descend into chaos immediately. It's probably better to deputize people at complete random to apprehend criminals than to take a really long time deciding. But if you have all your other memories, then you can pick particularly lawful people to be law enforcement. And then you need a minimal set of laws, probably no murder and no theft.
That part about not murdering people sounds like a good idea, but what sort of power gets granted to the no-murder enforcers? Maybe the few people who want to be murderers are much more likely than average to sign up for the no-murder enforcers, so they can secretly compact among themselves to get away with that. Well, Gregoria did say to pick people at random. If you pick people at random, and at least half of the people picked agree to serve, then maybe the system works for at least a week or two, and isn't immediately blown up by adversarial selection on the candidates applying for the position. Possibly everybody in the world could immediately agree on the random number system that said who should be an enforcer. Possibly almost everyone except the would-be murderers would decide to respect whatever powers the no-murder enforcers were given. These are Da'ath Elani, after all. They're pretty cooperative. Most of them. There's always exceptions. Still, if the system is going to last for more than a couple of hours, there should probably be some sort of meta-enforcers to watch the first set of enforcers. There's going to be at least some bad enforcers randomly picked in the system. Maybe they can do a disproportionate amount of damage, depending on what powers they have. Exactly. Let's set all that aside for the moment, though, because Gregoria then proceeded to say something really confusing. Theft. Keltham fails to recognize this concept. There's a bunch of stuff lying around. Does theft have something to do with that?
Do we have no records of who owns any of the stuff?
What's an own? Keltham can determine the color and shape of the various objects around him, but how would he determine the own of it?
Wow, okay. Then Gregoria is grabbing a knife and everything she can carry and getting the fuck out of here before the killing starts.
Someone ask the Tal'Dorei girls that question.
It's Doth Ilan, Gregoria. Very few people are going to try to kill anyone, and the ones who do will be swarmed by bystanders after a 5-second pause while they reinvent the concept of everybody commits to swarm the killer after 5 other people make the same commitment. Why is she grabbing a bunch of stuff, though? Was she planning to use it for something later? Why would you have to grab something now in order to use it later? Does this have something to do with that Aon stuff that nobody has explained to Keltham how to experimentally discern as a perceptible property of objects?
She's grabbing a bunch of stuff because she's pretty sure there's in fact no principled foundation for any distribution of the stuff other than people get what they can defend. So she should maintain custody of an amount of stuff that's not worth killing her over and is sufficient for survival.
Doth Ilan, Gregoria. The average intelligence of everybody involved in this process is 16, possibly 17. They remember learning about cooperation-defection dilemmas when they were very young. As soon as everybody visualizes the awful outcome from what Gregoria is describing, they will all automatically, because they do remember learning about cooperation-defection. Dilemmas as children ask themselves in unison, can we do something else which is not that, and end up not there? But really, they're getting ahead of themselves here. Gregoria seems to be visualizing a world in which if she's touching something, she gets to use it, and if she's not touching something, she doesn't get to use it. Why would this be the case? There's stuff lying around. Why the expectation that she gets to use it if she was previously touching it, but not if somebody else is touching it? This is a weird system. Keltham sees no reason to adopt this system himself. People who need stuff should use it, obviously.
That seems even more doomed than you own what you touch, but she admittedly can't explain why.
No one will work.
What is this work of which she speaks? In unrelated news, it looks like there's only enough non-perishable food lying around to feed everybody for a couple of years, after which everyone will starve. But surely, before that time comes around, some genius will imagine up something else to do, which is not that, and end up not there. It doesn't seem like an urgent problem.
Yes, the genius solution is credibly telling 85% of the people that if they go work on farms, they will get stuff as a result. So they go do that and everyone doesn't starve, which is why you get stuff needs to mean something.
Seems like they're skipping a lot of derivation steps here. Almost as if they somehow secretly knew which ultimate destination they wanted to arrive at, and were using the excuse of imminent starvation to immediately propose that solution as if it were the only possible one. There is a key skill taught in Doth Ilan called in Baslin blah blah blah. Actually, Keltham did cue a share language, communal, today, and might as well use it so he can, at the very least, use words like that one and have people hear the meaning as well as his definition. Gather round, tap tap tap, you all have baseline for 3 hours. There is a key skill taught in Doth Ilan called in baseline perspective taking, which is about carefully controlling your own mind to operate as if it were somebody else's mind, putting yourself into their own shoes and mirroring them in order to simulate them accurately. It has a crucial special case, perspective underscore taking of ignorance. In this case, they're being asked to simulate somebody who does not know, who has had forgotten and erased from their mind, what it means to own a thing. It is not, if you take that perspective properly, like unto the experience of looking at things, seeing no ownership tag on them, and jumping from there to the conclusion that other people might grab those things and own them, or fight over them and own them. You just see things. They have shapes and colors, but no property of being owned. That concept has been erased from you. We're not asking how do people reinvent ownership. They don't know they're trying to invent ownership. They're just pondering the question of how they might avoid starving in a couple of years. They might imagine that people need incentivizing to work on the farms. Why jump straight to the conclusion about rewarding them with ownership of the grain the farms produce? Maybe all the grain goes into a big grain storage unit, and they guard the perimeters of their land to keep out strangers, and only people who worked on the farms are allowed to wander into the big grain storage unit and take grain from there, but they still have no concept that the grain is tagged with a property of being owned by anyone, even themselves collectively. They're just working to grow grain and guarding it. The idea is not that this is a better solution, but that it is a simpler solution that seems to maybe solve the immediate problem of people starving in 2 years. Somebody thinking about just that problem, who didn't have a concept in their minds of ownership, might come up with this simpler solution that apparently solves the problem of immediate starvation in 2 years, before they invented anything as complicated as ownership. It would take some more difficult problem to motivate that one. This kind of perspective taking, in the special case of learning to think as if you've erased a piece of knowledge from your own mind, is a vital mental skill that appears as a subskill of many others. It appears, for example, in the art of figuring out which premises and lemmas are needed to reason step by step through a math proof. If you know too well that 3 times 3 is supposed to equal 9, if you can't go perspective underscore take on ignorance and block the great obviousness out of your mind, you'll have a harder time remembering that multiplication is defined out of addition. You will have a hard time coming up with the argument built up out of simpler terms, the one that says, well, to see why 3 times 3 is 9, consider that 3 plus 3 plus 3 is 9. Because it will be so obvious to you that 3 times 3 is 9 that you can no longer slow down and say why that is. You won't know that 3 plus 3 equals 6 is a critical step along the way to 3 times 3 equals 9. In the same sense, here, they're trying to grab private ownership by individuals out of air because it's so obvious that they can't properly erase it from their own minds as an available solution. And think of solutions simpler than that, which would also solve the simpler problems as they are being posed. Not as well, yes, but somebody with an erased mind wouldn't know their solution was worse than some other one. This skill of being able to blank out a habitual solution from your mind and look for a simpler one is also the same sort of skill you'd use to, say, look past Ione and Pilar and Carissa went off because of a conspiracy, where the thought of a conspiracy seems so ready to hand as a solution, and say, well, maybe Ione and Pilar went off with Carissa to fix some issue that happened because of Ione and Pilar being out of commission for a couple of days. If Keltham wasn't confident in his training in this skill of blanking out, he really wouldn't dare to consider conspiracy as a hypothesis because he actually would see it, inevitably everywhere, even in the ordinary world, as a solution that leaps to mind and blanks out other solutions and can't properly be forgotten. When Keltham first arrived at the World Wound, the 7th Circle wizard who showed up for his teleport told him that he'd be safer and more able to pursue his goals in Cheliax, and able to purchase passage back from Ostenso to elsewhere, and added, I give you my word. Keltham tried to explain to him that, from Keltham's perspective, the apparent implied information being presented to him was along the lines of, you would probably worry that if you go to this place in Ostenso, you might not be able to pay for passage back, and you wouldn't usually believe me if I just told you otherwise, but you'll probably believe me if I add, I give you my word about it. Keltham's actual state of ignorance was such that even this implied information was not very useful to him, because the main things he was doubting were on the order of, are those giant monsters inside the force field possibly the real good guys here? Or, does any such place as Cheliax actually exist? So reprise. Somebody has the bright idea of working the farms, defending the grain store, and only people who work on the farms are allowed to access the grain store, which is what incentivizes the farm work. They are, in a certain sense, guarding stuff. But they haven't really conceptualized it as something tagged with a person yet. They're guarding the stuff, but it's not tagged as their stuff, and this indeed is why it must be guarded. Anyone else could just come and take it, after all. What problem might they encounter next, and what solution might they invent for it that isn't just leaping straight to private property? Blank the solution you already know out of your mind.
Some people will be lazy and not do their share of the work.
Kick them out of the guarded farming area.
People accuse people they just don't like of slacking, to get them kicked out and get more food for themselves.
But if that actually decreases the farming labor, that will mean less food for themselves later on, because there'll be fewer workers? Perhaps this is only a failure mode that exists when people don't have enough food to go around. Keltham is also confused about how people would be able to credibly accuse random others they don't like of slacking. Obviously, there'd be one person assigned to monitor any particular other person's work and report whether they were slacking or not. Or rather, if they weren't already doing that, they'd start once the accusations of slacking began. If his students claim that can't work, are they sure they haven't just disproven the existence of corporations in general?
If you do that, then the person responsible for monitoring whether someone else is slacking can say, "I'll report you for slacking and get you expelled unless you bribe me."
Can't threaten Doth Alani, but the person who is slacking could offer the person monitoring favors in exchange for not reporting them. That's just a trade.
This does seem to prove that corporations in general cannot exist. Well done.
Well, they can't pay everyone the exact same thing, at least.
Keltham doesn't see how giving people different amounts of grain solves the problem, where you apparently can't trust managers not to take bribes to deliver inaccurate reports about how much their direct reports worked.
Well, the way you do it in Chelyaks is pay for work, hire hat makers per hat they turn in, and then no one's making a subjective report on anyone else's quality. They are paying per hat.
What if that gets you sloppily made low-quality hats?
The price is agreed in advance, and for each hat, you can pay it or not. So you pay for the hats worth that price, and don't buy the others.
Carissa sure is bringing in a lot of complicated infrastructure here. All this talk of pay. It would take a very great genius indeed to invent an infrastructure as complicated as this sounds, and bring it in as the best solution to the current problem about farming and slacking. If Keltham tries to extract just the useful part of this solution, it sounds like Carissa is saying that everybody should be assigned their own particular plot of land to farm, and then we look at whether somebody's produce yields past a certain minimum threshold, and people under that threshold get kicked out and don't get to eat. This is better because everybody can see whether a worker did enough work or not, and so they don't have the same problem with false accusations of slacking or managers taking bribes.
Maybe. But also, you could say they can only eat the grain that grew on their plot, and then they'll want that to be a lot of grain rather than a barely sufficient amount of grain.
So, if Keltham is getting this right, the key assumption is that people can direct varying levels of effort into farming, and higher efforts yield higher yields, and the higher yields are observable. So we assign everybody a plot of land. They get to keep all the food from that land, and that incentivizes everyone to... Well, actually, it incentivizes everyone to work just hard enough to feed themselves with pretty high probability. This brilliant trick eliminates the need for anybody else to monitor anyone. Some people will probably die of starvation due to bad luck, but better them than everyone. Sounds like the work of reconstructing civilization is all done. Just tag equal-sized lots of land as belonging to various individual people. Where the tags are a kind of social construct about who gets to eat the produce from the land. And we leave it up to whoever eats the produce to grow it. People seem to be talking about some system more complicated than that, but Keltham doesn't see yet why it would be necessary. Once you know which person gets to eat the edibles that grow on any particular piece of land, you're done.
Some people will trade.
What, so like some people have food, and other people have food, and they both give the food they have to each other? What a strange activity. Why would anyone do that?
Well, say you grew more food than you can eat, and someone else grew too little, and yours is just going to rot anyway. So you say to them, "You can eat my food if you also do some work on my farm while I laze around doing nothing."
They will inevitably slack off, making this project doomed to failure. Wasn't that the whole reason why land plots got tagged with people in the first place? Carissa isn't being consistent here in what she claims will go wrong. She only says things will go wrong with Keltham's ideas, and not that the same things will go wrong with her ideas. What an epistemically unfair way of arguing for relative attractiveness of policy judgments.
The problem with Keltham's proposal was that the slacker reviewers didn't have any reason to give accurate judgments, or even mostly accurate judgments. A person paying another person to work on their land for them wants to keep doing this if the person is doing a good job and not if they're slacking, and they can just tell them to stop and not trade them food if they're not doing good work.
All right, Keltham admits of the possibility that you would give somebody some of the food from your farm if in exchange they did some work on your farm. Now, has civilization been fully reinvented?
What if I'm starving but my crop will be ready in a week, Maritzel says, and I want to borrow some food from someone else for a week?
This added complexity seems well within the reach of Doth Alani. Sure, Now we're done, though.
Two farmers have a dispute, Tanya says. One says the other promised to pay for work. The other says that the work was shoddy, and the agreement was to only pay if the work was good.
Sounds pretty sad. Guess they won't be bargaining again next time.
That works in a small village, but Tanya thinks it won't work if they have too many people for everyone to know everyone else's reputation.
People should stay to small villages and farm until they have enough food, then.
Yep. Tanya thinks that's probably just correct about Galarian humans. But maybe the Doth Illani will be willing to add a ton of complexity in order to get to not live in villages.
Adding tons of complexity right away sounds like a bad idea. What's the next chunk of complexity that enables somebody to solve a problem that current small villages cannot?
Well, can two villagers combine their plots and be understood to have shared rights to the plot that results? Can villagers exchange their plots for food?
What customer problems are these new features intended to solve? We should make sure the customer has an exciting, important problem to which some feature is the simplest solution, before we spend a lot of time implementing, testing, and debugging that feature in our next-gen village design.
Well, combining two plots smooths out your variance in harvests, which is good, because having insufficient food is more bad than having too much food is good. And one other person is few enough for social enforcement against slacking to mostly work and for people to mostly get the benefits of their labor. And selling your plot for food is something you might do if you were imminently starving, because better to be in a bad situation later than right this minute.
Keltham supposes he's starting to see a bunch of value that could be unlocked by this system, in which to write down some of the rules so far. Food can be tagged with a socially constructed imaginary arrow that points to a particular person. Let's call them the owner. There's a socially respected rule, not a physical law, saying that only the owner of food can eat it. This rule of itself isn't obviously very useful on the face of it. If food just came out of nowhere, a rule like this would just prevent hungry people from eating food that's nearby. Or at least, nobody else has explained yet why you'd want Coker socially underscore constructed ownership underscore tags for food if it just came out of nowhere. However, this rule becomes visibly useful when combined with a new one. Land can be tagged with a socially constructed imaginary pointer to an owner. There's a socially respected rule saying that all food which grows from that land then gets tagged with the same owner, and those food tags are then respected as above. This incentivizes people to invest increasing amounts of effort into farming their land, since they get more food and more reliable food in proportion to putting in more effort. This seems probably more efficient than having a whole group guarding a lot of land, and then also expending effort on monitoring how much effort all those people are putting into farming. Monitoring the monitors, trying to have an incentive system that encourages the right amount of farming, etc. Though obviously this whole tagging system is also going to have social costs. Still, it's plausible the tagging system is more efficient. It has a compact local physical relationship between how much people work and how much they eat, instead of a complicated socially constructed one involving lots of monitoring and people with power over other people who might go corrupt. Now some new rules are being proposed, which seem to say things like, people who tag land or food can, as a voluntary action, taken under particular circumstances, announce that the pointer should change to point to somebody else instead. You can announce today that some of the food your land produces later will, when it appears, get tagged with a pointer to somebody else instead. There's a social construct whereby multiple atomic actions and conditions of this kind can be packaged together into a single-bound molecule, he's using the same words as in chemistry, that only gets socially respected as a single piece after everybody involved has made the necessary announcements. You can trade a lot of food for a bit of land, but not in a way where you announce that the food tag points to somebody else now, and then they can say ha-ha and refuse to announce the change on their land tag. You say, change the ownership pointer on this food to them, and that land to me. And the other says, change the ownership pointer on this land to them, and that food to me. And the joint declaration only gets socially respected after all tagged parties have announced the same molecule arrangement of the same atomic actions. The Taldane word for this would probably be contract, or something like that. There's a single-syllable word, contract, in baseline, but the more technical term would be multi-signature transaction. These new rules unlock potential actions, like trade some of your land's future food for food you can eat right now, as might be a good thing, if something went wrong with this year's labor, as sometimes happens. Though you know you could also see how that sort of thing could potentially go wrong, especially if any of the people involved were reasoning less than perfectly. Still, let's ignore that part for now and plunge ahead. As of the most recent suggestions, somebody was proposing that two pieces of land could be owned by two people. Keltham's not sure he could back them on this idea. This sounds fraught. If food has a tag pointing at two people, who gets to eat the food if the two of them disagree about who should eat it? Do both of them have to agree on who eats the food and announce that socially using multiple signatures before it can be eaten? If people end up in angry, lasting disagreements, does the food rot? That seems like a waste. Keltham thinks the system should say that any socially constructed tag points to one place. But you could, maybe, allow people to announce a multi-signature transaction, whereby the tags shift to point to a new social construct that isn't a person, and instead can be a complicated imaginary construct, like Fairbot or Prudentbot. This new construct could say, for example, that both of the announcers will now own shares in the land, and the food produced by the land will be tagged to the people who own the shares, in proportion to how many shares they own. And that these shares themselves now have ownership tags, and those tags can be moved around in multi-signature transactions. This new, persistent, complicated, imaginary construct, to actually be socially effective, would have to be something that all the people who are supposed to respect the tags and the multi-signature transactions would be able to understand. If somebody can't understand what the new, complicated, imaginary social construct does, they can't figure out who's socially allowed to eat the food. There's obviously going to have to be a socially constructed specification language for imaginary constructs like these, and some persistent contracts in the specification language could potentially fail to validate because they don't fulfill all the conditions that society demands from a contract. For instance, if you try to announce a complicated contract where, under some circumstances, food ends up with no ownership tag and nobody is allowed to eat it and it rots, the people around might tell you that your contract fails to validate and that they won't respect this contract even if it's announced. They might then, if they feel like being helpful, suggest a debugged version of your contract in which all the food always ends up with a well-formed ownership pointer, and say that they'd respect that contract instead. Any farmer who tries to announce a contract in which they trade a cherry to themselves and end up owning all the food in existence would similarly be told by other farmers that their contract fails to validate because they haven't fulfilled the condition in this whole imaginary system that everybody is maintaining inside their own imaginations, that you need signatures from all the parties in a molecular transaction who are currently deemed to own anything whose tag gets shifted around in the transaction. Likewise, if you said that the food produced by land gets owned in proportion to how much work two people put into it, society would tell you that your contract doesn't validate because society can't directly observe how much work was put in. Society needs all the terms in a contract to be evaluable by society in order for the contract to validate. Any fact referred to inside an expression needs to be one that society can observe, cheaply, by the time society needs to evaluate the expression.
To be clear, civilization doesn't literally think that contract specification languages were invented by farmers immediately after they invented ownership as a social construct. It's widely suspected that this wouldn't have occurred until hundreds of years later, after people got in some practice with simpler systems. This would, however, probably have been the first use case for the explicit idea of a programming language, invented thousands of years before anyone could build an actual computer.
That's not how actual farmers do things here, just so we're clear, says Tanya faintly.
Yeah, the intelligence 10 thing is having really weird effects on their society. His students are now being exposed to the sort of thinking that happens in a world where they're normal average people instead of smart people.
How does this hypothetical society handle contract disputes or contract breaking?
Well, there's presumably something you have to do if an individual defector from society goes around eating other people's food. Even a tiny fraction of people like that can do a lot of damage. And of course, You'll have even more of them if you don't build any way of stopping them. There's probably some kind of police investigator whose job it is to hunt down food thieves, and then that person has to eat. Well, they probably get a small fraction of food from a lot of farms, and the police don't protect any farms that don't contribute those little bits of food. And thieves target those farms, and only those farms that don't have police investigators. If you need that mechanism anyways, the police then have to decide what is thievery in the first place, and keep track of where the tags go. So probably the police would be the main ones, where you'd want them to tell you that the contracts validate. Though, obviously, you'd also want the other people in your society to agree on not coming over and taking your food. You wouldn't want any contracts which were complicated to the point where other members in society couldn't figure out that they shouldn't eat your food. The notion of a contract breaking is a weird one. For a contract to validate, the police should always be able to figure out what to do in any case of observable terms. The contract might say that if somebody doesn't do some deed, or rather something the police can observe about that, like some contracted observer saying that somebody didn't do a deed, some land or food they own then belongs to somebody else, and the person who didn't do the deed might lose reputation about that. But contracts shouldn't break so much as describe what happens in unpleasant contingencies as seen from a police perspective. If the police can't figure out what a contract means, if there's a dispute the contract doesn't imply how to resolve, then they need to do more careful validation next time. But sure, you could have some sufficiently respected group of 5 people whose majority would decide what would happen in the hopefully very rare cases of contracts that validated and shouldn't have.
And if the police is corrupt, everyone who is paying them, since they're doing that voluntarily, can just start paying someone else instead?
As long as they can collectively outfight the hypothetical corrupted governance military, yes. This is easy while everyone's a farmer. The police outfight individual thieves, all the farmers together win against the police. If all this social complexity enables you to build more powerful weapons, and the police have those weapons, and nobody else has those weapons, then there is perhaps a bit of a problem. If you count the rehearsal festivals for it, civilization spends more on making sure civilization can collectively outfight the hypothetical corrupted governance military than civilization spends on its actual military. And even then, there's some real and awful questions about whether, for example, the military plus the keepers could take the rest of civilization. There's an order of meta-keepers whose job is specifically just keep an eye on the keepers. And in real life, that's probably worth anything. The keepers hopefully can't win against all the rest of civilization, plus its usual military, and the usual military is in fact specifically designed to resist hypothetical corrupted keepers. One similarly tries to make it hard for the keepers collectively and the military collectively to trust each other in a pact to take over together, especially when they were already betraying their oaths to civilization. It's hard to have a really simple reason why governance couldn't possibly go corrupt once your weaponry reaches the level of giant flaming craters. Civilization has thrown complicated solutions at this because they don't have simple solutions, and nobody is happy about that. But just don't build overly powerful weapons isn't an answer, because how do you stop rogue groups from building those, possibly in secret, if there's such a prize to be won by being the only group with overly powerful weapons?
What is Keltham's estimate of the probability governance secretly was corrupt? Maritzel asks.
Which failure mode? What counts as corrupt? There was probably at least one person somewhere in governance who was corrupt. The whole thing being secretly full of Keltham doesn't know, people getting paid much more than their theoretical salaries, with secret mansions full of full-time sex workers, that seems legit unlikely. Keltham once tried to do his own totally separate checks on what civilization could be hiding in the ways of massive secret projects. It looked to him like at most 2% of the economy was being hidden off the books, at least in ways that didn't require a really massive conspiracy with tons and tons of data being falsified and lots of people outside of governance being in on it, which would be a lot easier for them if they actually had a good reason. Keltham doesn't know. Here the parts of civilization he got to see were pretty nice to him, especially by Galarian standards. He supposes he'd be ticked to find out that actually half the female population was masochists, but he was prevented from finding out that he was a sadist in order to leave more masochists for people in on the conspiracy? It seems legit. Hard to hide a massive government conspiracy in Dath Elan. Unless there's a good reason that gets the keepers and lots of civilians who'd notice an anomaly in their section to go along with that. Keltham is really having a hard time evaluating this probability. If they're hiding mansions, they're good at that. It leaves him mainly with priors, plus his guess that a dark conspiracy doesn't train people to think non-conformingly and be ready to defeat the hypothetical corrupted governance military. Maybe 2%?
To Chellish ears, that sounds kind of outrageously low. Though, it's hard to argue that dark conspiracies don't usually encourage you to think non-conformingly and be ready to defeat the government militarily.
If there were a conspiracy, says Gregoria, with the sort of people that exist in Golarion, it wouldn't be to divvy up all the actually plentiful masochists unfairly and have mansions with full-time sex workers.
Keltham is sincerely confused about what the point of the Dark Death conspiracy would be. Does Golarion wish to enlighten him?
It would be to just have painful sex with people who don't like it since there aren't any masochists, says Gregoria flatly. And to not pay them, because why would you pay them? And to frame people who offended you for crimes, and to murder people and make it look like an accident. I don't think there's a conspiracy in Cheliax, but if there is, her infernal magistrix is not hoarding masochists.
Obviously, Abigail isn't hoarding masochists. There are masochists right here, not being hoarded. They are allegedly plentiful enough here that nobody would need to hoard them. And what is the actual point of this dark conspiracy? Keltham can imagine that there are some criminal sociopaths in governance with sexualities not quite like his, who can get off on inflicting pain on somebody who isn't responding sexually to that, and to whom it doesn't mean anything emotionally except as something to hate. He can imagine that if some dark group of dark conspirators had managed to secretly take over Dath Elan anyways, the criminal sociopath sadists among them would be having sex with non-masochists so long as they were at it. He's not seeing that being the whole point of the conspiracy.
I think mostly people want power for its own sake, for the sake of being able to do whatever they want. Because they did one murder and were already going to be frozen if they got caught, so why not do anything at all to avoid getting caught?
Keltham is following you on the part where somebody who did one true murder and will be suspended if caught would prefer to become sole ruler over the world, in preference to being caught and frozen. The part where there are enough people like this, successfully and stably cooperating with each other while defecting against the rest of civilization, that they can take over the government and the keepers. Look, Keltham was raised in a way where, if one single member of the hypothetical conspiracy had managed to broadcast to the rest of civilization the whole truth about the conspiracy's grimdark misdeeds, and told everyone where to look for evidence and proof, and then demanded a billion gold pieces in exchange for that, plus that the next few attractive true murderers of the appropriate sex be turned over to them for sadistic purposes, as would be less than 1/10,000th the number of victims under the previous regime, etc. The obvious thing to do would have been to pay them after overthrowing the conspiracy. There is very plausibly a non-dark conspiracy using 2% of civilization's resources on something important and terribly secret. You can tell this because Keltham has, in fact, now that he reflects on it, been brought up in a way that would make him feel like this is the obviously right and proper thing to do if you have some important thing to be running a non-dark conspiracy about, and everybody would owe the keepers and upper governance gratitude for having taken on this secret duty. If there was a dark conspiracy, Keltham should have been raised much more on a diet of messages about how, in hypothetical dark conspiracy Dath Elan's, if you try to blow the whistle on them instead of joining them for scraps at the table, they will inevitably catch you and turn you over to their sadists to be made use of, and then tossed to the true death when they're done with you. And not raised, as Keltham actually was raised, on a steady diet of fictional messages about how, in a world like that, you need to keep the secret and organize with your friends and overthrow the dark conspiracy. Nor should he possess the decision theory about how to coordinate counter-conspiracies like that. How to wait for an obvious beacon time to naturally occur, like a solar eclipse or something, and have 10% of the population shout, "Now!" followed by the other 90% shouting, "Now!" and suddenly turning on their hypothetical dark overlords. the dark conspiracy that supposedly rules Dath Ilan, is really impressively faking the part where the ordinary people like Keltham are being brought up in a way that makes the dark conspiracy's life more difficult and dangerous. If they're trying to counter-signal to Keltham how ordinary they are using costly signals, that plot really has succeeded. Keltham wouldn't do that if he were the dark conspiracy.
Probably the dark conspiracy pretends to be the non-dark conspiracy using 2% of civilization's resources on something important and terribly secret. If there's room for one of those.
They're really, really not doing it the way Keltham would do it, even taking into account that they could be trying to fool him about that. Dath Ilani kids get their parents fooling them about certain things for years, until the kids figure it out on their own, despite the actual coordinated conspiracy of adults trying to fool children about those things, with the purpose specifically of training Dath Ilani children to break out of false realities. If nobody had ever done that to Keltham, he really wouldn't have jumped up and said, "Aha!" Civilization clearly ought to be elaborately training children to break out of false realities and isn't. This must be the work of a dark conspiracy. It's not something a dark conspiracy would be wise to do, even taking into account that this is exactly what they'd like you to believe.
It is at this point that Asmodia truly and properly appreciates how much Pharasma must personally hate her and her life.
Sure. Gregoria finds that pretty convincing. She really only strongly objected to Keltham's lack of imagination about what conspiracies do when they exist. It sounds like he has pretty good reason to think they don't.
Well, to be fair, civilization does not have records about really serious large-scale conspiracies. And if Galarian does, it is very possible that Keltham needs to be educated about this. This is more than usually likely to be a point where Galarian has something to teach the silly, naive Dath Ilani. For that matter, if civilization actually is run by a dark conspiracy, Keltham plausibly would have been raised with huge, obvious blind spots about it that somebody from Galarian could see through. It's a great place to probe Keltham hard and try to catch him out in some blatant error he apparently isn't realizing for some odd reason.
They will totally take that as a challenge. No blatant errors yet, though.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to executive producer John Doe 7776059.